Let me have men about me that are fat, commented Julius Caesar in William Shakespeare's play of the same name. Sleek-headed men, and such as sleep o' nights. Yon Cassius has a lean and hungry look. He thinks too much. Such men are dangerous. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, Director of Distance Learning at Wyoming Catholic College. Welcome to the After Dinner Scholar, the college's weekly podcast about the great books and the liberal arts. Behind the personal conflicts in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, says Dr. Kahil Habib, the bard is making the case that politics always swims downstream from culture. While Caesar, Brutus, Cassius, and the others believe they are driving changes in Rome, it is instead changes in Rome and Roman culture that drive the events. The great men are riding the crests or sinking in the troughs of the waves. That is, history makes men and women far more than men and women make history. Dr. Habib, in addition to being Associate Professor of Philosophy and Director of the Pell Honors Program at Salve Regina University, is a member of the Wyoming Catholic College Board of Directors. Dr. Habib is also our guest this week on the After Dinner Scholar. Dr. Habib, in a lecture you gave entitled Shakespeare as Statesman, Leadership Lessons from the Bard, you pointed out the difference between Plutarch's assessment of Julius Caesar and Shakespeare's. What is that difference, and why do you believe one is more accurate?
Well, it's difficult to know who's more accurate. There's a contest between a variety of writers as to who can capture the character of not only Rome in its early stages, a republic, and later stages, an empire, but also just the character of the people involved, whether they're individuals like Julius Caesar, Anthony Cleopatra, and just the nature of the tribunes or the nature of the people that they represent. It's not clear who has the accurate picture, but there is a competition, if you will, to see who could present Rome and its heroes in a certain light. Plutarch looks at Julius Caesar and looks at all the great lives in Greek and Roman lives, really assessing them on their own personal merits. He examines their vices and their virtues. Shakespeare seems to do that, but he adds one addition that makes him, for me, just even that much more complicated than Plutarch, and in many ways more rewarding. Shakespeare always looks at the changes in politics that take place that often impose themselves upon certain characters. So, for example, when Julius Caesar begins, you can already see that the people have grown so powerful that they no longer even need the tribunes that they worked so hard to earn in the previous play in Coriolanus. And so, in many ways, Shakespeare and also Machiavelli wrote a book on Rome, entitled The Discourses in the First 10 Books of Titus Livy. Machiavelli is the first to really emphasize the role of the people, the plebs as he calls them, in shaping Roman politics. Prior to Machiavelli, the focus had always been on the great men and women, primarily the men. After Machiavelli, you start to get a sense of just how important the institutions that formed out of certain clashes between factions played in shaping Rome as a republic and then later as an empire. So when you look at Shakespeare, one of the major differences between him and Plutarch is he really does seem to be following the Machiavellian perspective, only insofar as he's now taking into consideration precisely the role of the people in shaping Coriolanus' self-understanding, Julius Caesar's self-understanding, but also the very institutions that can often increase the strength or representation of one group at the expense of another. So in Coriolanus, for example, you have the embodiment of Roman courage and valor, Coriolanus. He's unrecognizable to us today. He seems just unforgivingly haughty and arrogant. From the perspective of the Roman Republic, though, he embodies the spirit of valor. He sees himself as tied to the Greek tradition, even. He's the Achilles, if you will, of his day. And when you see that particular play, you see just how important it was for the people to gain representation in the tribunes. And so when you look at Julius Caesar, the play, you see just how successful the tribunes had in fact become in representing the people, how they had eventually, by just sheer military might, having been assimilated into the military and been part of the expansion of Rome, had even rendered the tribunes even unnecessary. So there's a degree of independence in the beginning of Julius Caesar, that also helps us to understand why he was so celebrated by the people. He became the ultimate tribune, revered almost as a god, you know, ruling over the known world. And then you see a very different shift taking place in that particular play that's not really examined in Plutarch. Plutarch generally focuses almost exclusively on the character. He does, of course, look at certain issues that shaped the lives of somebody, their particular birth, their experiences growing up, but never the degree to which Shakespeare and Machiavelli do in terms of climate, geography, the institutions that come and go, and the necessities that those create for certain characters. So that's a bit of a long answer, sorry.
No, that's great. So really, Shakespeare, who wrote four plays about Rome, Coriolanus, Julius Caesar, Antony and Cleopatra, and Titus Andronicus. I mean, you seem to indicate that rather than being four separate stories, Shakespeare is telling us something about Roman history and about even the nature of politics.
Absolutely. What you see in Shakespeare's Roman plays is, in Coriolanus, you see Rome in its early stage, just after having overturned, you know, the Tarquin tyranny, the monarchy that was there before. Coriolanus's family and some of the characters in the play were partly involved in that. Then you see the expansion that takes place. And then in Julius Caesar, you see that turning point in Roman history where it goes from a republic to an empire. And that was just an existential crisis for many people, because it had been accustomed for centuries, defined itself in opposite of the tyrannies that it had to suffer under Tarquin. All of a sudden, you now have one of their own becoming sole ruler. And of course, that leads to the famous murder by Brutus and his conspirators. But the play really shows that, again, the political situation had changed beyond the control of Brutus and the conspirators. There's nothing they could have done to have reversed the shift. And that's what makes Shakespeare so unique from Plutarch. Plutarch would just look at the individual person. How did Jim handle this or that situation? Shakespeare looks at the situation and say, how did, in addition to that, how did the action taken on, frankly, lead nowhere, because there was a certain blindness to the political situation. Brutus was too attached to the Republic to see that the world has moved on. It is now an empire. In Antony and Cleopatra, you see an imperial, the grandeur now of an imperial Rome. And you finally see in that play, love conquer the warrior spirit. Antony and Cleopatra are both presented as deities. And now you could examine the most powerful love affair the world has ever seen, because now they can play their love out almost on a godlike stage. Antony controls a third of the world. Cleopatra is a ruler in her own right. But at that point, the discrepancy between the great men who made Rome and the military who has to look up to them and respect them has grown so vast that this is now really the twilight and the beginning of the end. It begins with some really nasty comments by generals on Antony and on Cleopatra. They cannot respect a man who's been conquered by love. For just under a millennia, you have this war machine now witnessing one of their greats, from their perspective, succumbing to just a life of hedonism and frivolity. Obviously, Shakespeare thinks there was more to that with Antony, but from the perspective of Rome, he just at that point was a foreigner, just a complete outsider. They couldn't make heads or tails of him. And again, they're excused somewhat by the political circumstances in which they find themselves. You cannot rule an empire that vast, especially with the ambition of all of the players that are there. So Shakespeare quietly excuses Antony and Cleopatra, but then shows us that you could see love writ large on such an epic scale. You could see what love ultimately seeks and longs for when it's cut from necessity. And I'll give you an example. One of the most famous lines in Antony and Cleopatra is when Cleopatra asks Antony, how much do you love me? Well, everybody who's ever experienced love knows you cannot quantify that. The answer, of course, is absolutely. And what the lover seeks is to possess an absolute human experience that cannot be taken away from one. And that's what the tragedy of the play is. And it becomes an alternative to the complete decline and the decay that's taking place politically and militaristically around them. And so love becomes an alternative there to both the Republic and the Empire, but of course it ends tragically. In Titus Andronicus, many people don't even read it as part of the Roman cycle. I do. And the reason why they don't is because none of the characters are historical. You have names like Titus throughout history, but there is no Titus Andronicus like you have in this particular play. What you see in that play, which often is overshadowed with just the violence, is a return to a savagery and barbarism that had originally given birth to Rome. This was the condition Rome was in, early Rome. It was constantly under threat by foreigners. It was constantly dealing with conflicting religious traditions. And Rome really grew out of a defensive posture to protect its own and also expand and to further its what it believed was its destiny. So Titus Andronicus shows you what happens to a civilization after it loses its sense of war, it loses its sense of order, it loses its sense of moral virtue, it loses its tradition, it has no place anymore for valor and men and women who contribute and devote their lives to the regime. One of the problems Titus has to face is he's almost an anachronism. He comes back from a conquest and he brings back captured slaves, Tamara and her children and her lover, Aaron. And what's interesting about that is he comes back to a Rome that he doesn't even realize has also changed. He's in the same position as Brutus. He still wants to go by the old traditions of burial. He still thinks that he is sacrificing his children and his life to a great Rome. He doesn't realize, too, that it is over. And so he's a man out of place, and almost every single character in that play seems like a person out of place. They just, nobody seems to fit or belong in anything. And so it's a bit of a disjointed play, but I think that's intentional, because when Rome fell, or when any civilization falls, what mechanisms and what virtues, what understanding can help anyone involved in such a situation understand the collapse of their civilization? How do they deal with the violence that perhaps the over-refined laws and luxury hid from sight? It's sort of like a civilization that's become commercial and has broken with its past and its tradition, doesn't seem to see violence much, and then all of a sudden it's struck by violence internally and it's caught off guard and isn't sure how to deal with it. So it's an interesting play, and it's one of my favorites, frankly, but it is complicated, and it does seem that it's a bit out of context with the rest of the plays, but I do believe that they are related.
How does Shakespeare's analysis of Rome apply to the world today? It all sounds very familiar.
Yeah. Well, of course, the one note that is often performed and read whenever the country feels that it's elected a potential dictator is Julius Caesar. It's related to today in that we are in many ways the product of extremely enlightened founders. They had read Montesquieu, they had read Machiavelli, they were obviously familiar with Shakespeare, certainly all of the Roman heroes. The Federalist Papers use pen names from Roman characters. And our understanding really does stem from the Enlightenment. You know, we have institutional mechanisms, checks and balances, separation of powers, but we're also a republic. But we're not a republic in the way that Rome was, and we're more of a commercial republic. And if you look at, for example, Federalist 9, there's a warning against going for the model of ancient Greece as a republic, or in Italy, because it was completely politically unstable, and it was ambition that was just unbridled and extremely dangerous. And so the founders really also look at Rome just as Shakespeare did and just as Machiavelli did and just as Plutarch. And they really want to understand what exactly was good about Rome and what contributed to its fall, what contributed to its success. Machiavelli is the first to show that the conflicts between the people and the Senate and the necessity to have to represent the people through tribunes created a stability in the face of conflict. And so what emerged accidentally was a system of checks and balances, a separation of powers. This becomes a major theme in philosophers like Montesquieu. He's the second most quoted thinker for the founders. And you can see that what the founders had in mind was sort of taking the best and hoping to avoid the worst from what they've learned from Shakespeare, from the Plutarchs of the world, from Machiavelli, from Montesquieu. And so the relevancy is, in spite of our institutional mechanisms in this country, Shakespeare's plays still provide readers with a certain understanding of political dilemmas. For example, one of the things I say in the lecture that you were referring to earlier is, from Shakespeare's perspective, you can see that politics always follows culture. When culture changes, when a people go from traditional to less traditional, or from morally austere and not, their laws become ineffectual. Their laws seem anachronistic. And so politics always follows where culture is going. And I think that that's a very important lesson that you can learn from Shakespeare, because it shows the importance and the necessity of civic education and not resting on your laurels and assuming that institutions are simply going to just take care of themselves and the country can be on autopilot. No, the threat of demagoguery is always real. The threat of mob is always real. And there's always going to be people who feel completely out of place, misrepresented, who just would like to sow dissension and sedition. And you find characters like that throughout. There's a beautiful, it's a horrifying scene, but it's beautifully depicted in Julius Caesar, where a mob kills somebody who they thought was an enemy. He just happened to share the same name. But it was, did he just shared the name only? Wasn't even the same person, and the mob nevertheless killed him. So just when you think this is just a kind of a bizarre story, there was a case recently where somebody with the same name as someone who was a statue during the Southern period was fired from his job. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. Like the scene in Shakespeare, the only thing he had in common was the name. They didn't even have, believe he was even Asian, had nothing to do with anything going on with the tensions in this country. And so there are little vignettes in so many of Shakespeare's plays that really, really go to the heart of just what it means to be a human being. And just because you are in a very large and relatively stable and peaceful commercial republic does not mean that problems that we all have to face don't arise. And when they do, we're fortunate to have someone like Shakespeare as educator.
Thank you very much. The author of Ecclesiastes wrote, "Do not say, why were the old days better than these? For it is not wise to ask such questions." The old days are over and gone. We can never restore them or reclaim them or resurrect them. Culture has changed, and the old days depended on a culture that is as past as they are. What we can do is approach this moment in history, the moment in history God has providentially entrusted to us, and seek new ways to incarnate and communicate the timeless truths of the faith once delivered to the saints. In this, authors like Shakespeare can be an enormous help. And this is also our fervent hope as we educate students at Wyoming Catholic College, Salve Regina University, and other faithfully Catholic schools. In this, your encouragement, prayers, and financial support make all the difference. Thank you. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.